There are some things that are true in the days of the judges that remain true throughout most of Israelite history. And one of those things is the way that women are treated. This is an ancient time in Israel. It's very patriarchal. I think God intended the marriage relationship to be much more balanced than Israel assumed it should be. And I'll give you just one verse to help you with that. Exodus chapter 20, you'll find the Ten Commandments, the Ten Words. On the Sabbath day, this is Exodus chapter 20, verse 8. Listen to this language very carefully. I think this prepares us for what's happening in the book of Judges and the life of Samson. It says this in the New Revised Standard Version. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work. You, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the alien resident in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and earth and the sea and all that is in them, but rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it. Verse 12, honor your father and your mother. Do you notice anyone missing from the list of folks who were not to do any work on the Sabbath? The wife isn't listed. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor. Again, this is terrible in English. We don't have a plural you, but it's plural. You all. Maybe that's the best we can do, y'all. You shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work. And who's that written to? Who's the you? You shouldn't do any work, nor anybody else in your household. But the you is plural. How is that to be taken? I think God meant it to be taken as the husband and wife together. Both heads of household. Because the very next verse in chapter 12 is honor your father. Right? No, your father and your mother. I think even in the law of Moses, God is trying to be countercultural to the Middle East. But the people are so rooted in that culture, they don't hear it. It takes a long time for them to get it. But the story in Judges 13 is another story in which God tries to drive home that he does not treat the wife and the husband differently. But Manoah doesn't get that. Judges chapter 13. So I want you to hear the story, and what I want you to hear is the way God is treating Manoah's wife, because by this time in Israelites' history, the wife was considered a lesser person in the home. The patriarch, the father, is the one who negotiates all treaties, who makes all vows, who does all the leadership. This is the person in charge. Now, we've already seen God subvert that in the book of Judges, right? Called Deborah to be the judge over a huge area. How did they know Deborah was called by God? She prophesied things and they always came true. And so they couldn't disagree with her, right? So they were forced. Deborah was forced upon them, but she led Israel. So God has already subverted this. But what you'll notice in the book of Judges is that the worse the people get, the worse women are treated. You notice how Samson treats women in this story? First, his mother's not even named, just this woman. Only his dad gets a name. What does he call his wife? My heifer. That's very flattering. As the story goes on, we're going to get into the story of a Levite and his concubine who hands over his wife she's his wife, concubine, to be raped all night till she's dead. Then he cuts her up into 12 pieces and mails her all over Israel. As the story goes, women get treated worse and worse and worse by the men, but not by God. And that's going to lead us into the story of 1 Samuel, where a woman is crying at the altar begging for children, and God hears her prayer. Hannah. So I want you to recognize that there's a theme that begins here. It actually picks up in the life of Mary, too. According to the law of Moses, she didn't have the right to make a vow. God should have gone to her father and negotiated this deal, but he doesn't. He goes right to her and lets her make the vow. And she says yes, and he only goes to Joseph after he's gone to Mary and got her consent. Very strange stuff God is doing, but it's consistent with a pattern that begins here in Judges chapter 13. This may be the first, maybe not. Hagar is a possible story like this. But Judges chapter 13, verse 1. The Israelites again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and I may skip some things, and the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. There was a certain man of Zorah, of the tribe of the Danites, whose name was Manoah. He's named. His wife was barren, having borne no children. So we start out here not just with a woman in the time of the judges, which it was not pleasant to be, according to most of the stories, but a barren woman. She was considered the least of women if she was married but could not bear children. Children guaranteed an inheritance, guaranteed someone to take care of these folks when they were old, someone to inherit their property, someone to carry on the family name. And so to have no children was a curse. And you see that all through the script. Sarah struggles with not having children. Rachel struggles with not having children. Manoah's wife is not able to have children. Hannah is not able to have children. Who else? Elizabeth is not able to have children. Just keeps running and running and running, right? There was a certain man of Zorah of the tribe of the Danites. His name was Manoah. His wife was barren, having borne no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to, the way this should go, is Manoah, the head of household. Should have gone to the one in charge. The angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, this is a person who doesn't even deserve a name in the history of Israel. That's who God comes to, right? Angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, although you are barren, having borne no children, you shall conceive and bear a son. Does that sound exactly like what God said to Mary? You shall conceive and bear a son. Now be careful not to drink wine or strong drink or to eat anything unclean, for you shall conceive and bear a son. Now do you hear what he's asking her to do? Take a vow. She has to live under the Nazarite vow until Samson is born, so that he will have been under a Nazarite vow from birth, from conception. But she wasn't allowed to make a vow without her husband's permission, according to the law of Moses. What's God doing? It's he who shall begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Then the woman came and told her husband, a man of God came to me. His appearance was like that of an angel of God, most awe-inspiring. I did not ask him where he came from, and he did not tell me his name. But he said to me, you shall conceive and bear a son. So then drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from birth to the day of his death. Isn't this a strange situation God has put this woman in? Manoah does not like this order of things. Manoah entreated the Lord. So Manoah goes to prayer. Manoah entreated the Lord and said, oh Lord, I pray, let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what we are to do concerning the boy who will be born. He already knows what's to be done about the boy, but he wasn't told. His wife was told. God should tell him. And I love what God does. God listened to Manoah, and the angel of the Lord came to him. Is that what your text says? No, he sends her to his wife again, you know? And so God listened to Manoah, and the angel of God came again to the woman as she sat in the field, but her husband Manoah was not with her. So the woman ran quickly and told her husband, the man who came to me the other day appeared to me. He's here. You know, that's what she's saying. Manoah got up and followed his wife and came to the man and said, are you the man who spoke to my adoring, lovely wife? Are you the one who spoke to this woman? And he said, I am. Then Manoah said, now when your words come true, I'm not doubting you. What's to be the boy's rule of life? What's he to do? Now, God had already told his wife what he was going to do. He was going to begin to deliver the people from the Philistines. Manoah wants it again. I want to hear it. The angel of the Lord said to Manoah, I love this. Let the woman give heed to all I said to her. I'm not going to tell you anything I didn't tell her. Why am I here? She may not eat of anything that comes from the vine. She's not to drink wine or strong drink or eat any unclean thing. So he's reminding him. She's to observe everything I commanded her. Manoah said to the angel, and then he's trying to get the angel to stay and he wants a blessing and all the stuff that, you know, the characters in this story want. Gideon did the exact same thing. This is a repetition, right? They want him to stay. They want him to eat. They want to get more information. They want to pump him for stuff. And he just won't have it. So why is this so important? God always gives special attention to the folks that society doesn't much care to give special attention to. And that is really what the Sermon on the Mount begins by saying. If you have your Bibles, you can turn to Matthew chapter 5. But really, as we begin to unfold who Jesus is and what he wants to do, we find that Jesus embodies the God of the First Testament in almost every way. And in one way especially, when society says that person doesn't stand as tall as these other people, God always chooses the shortest person. And he lifts them up. Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Jesus starts out by saying, the kingdom of heaven is for those of you who have been excluded. All of these characteristics in the Roman world and in the world of Judaism, these folks would have been considered cursed by God. Blessed are the poor in spirit. It's not good to have poverty of spirit. This is a person who doesn't get much done, who doesn't have much motivation, who is not an achiever, who is not ambitious. This is a person without much energy. Blessed are the poor in spirit. But those folks are excluded because in the kingdoms of this earth, without a lot of get up and go, what happens? The world gets up and goes and you're left behind. But Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. He's not saying strive to be poor in spirit, but if you've been excluded because you don't fit in to the way the world works, blessed are you because a kingdom is coming where you will fit. Blessed are those who mourn. Nobody's blessed who mourns. We never mourn in deep anguish and feel blessed. Those people are excluded. What happens if someone whines around you too much? You decide you don't want to spend any time with them. Those who mourn are pushed out. We get tired of it. It fatigues us. It wears us out. We don't want to be around these people. Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn. You will find comfort. This kingdom is for you. Blessed are the meek. Meekness is smallness. Meekness are the people that you walk into a room, you look right past them. They're invisible. They don't stand out. These are the meek. They don't fit into the world. But Jesus says, blessed are you who are meek, who are looked over. The earth will be yours. This is a different kingdom. This thing is upside down. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Let's not lie to ourselves, folks. People who hunger and thirst for righteousness are labeled loony and extremists. We want people who hunger and thirst after everybody's okay. You're okay, I'm okay. I don't get into your stuff. You don't get into my stuff. I'll help you if you need me, but I'll never impose. Those are the people like. They do not like people who hunger and thirst after righteousness. But in this kingdom, you'll be filled. Blessed are the merciful. Now we talk about mercy as this great thing, and it is sometimes, but believe me, if mercy gets too merciful, it looks like a monstrosity. No one can seek justice and hold up mercy. Mercy is an unjust thing to do. People should get what they deserve. Mercy says they should get what they do not deserve. People want justice. They don't want mercy. But Jesus says, blessed are the merciful, for you will receive the mercy you give. This is a different kind of kingdom, because in our kingdoms, blessed are the just, because they make for a safer world. Blessed are the peacemakers. Now we can think too that peacemaking, that's a good thing. We love peacemakers, don't we? Well, it depends on who the enemies are. Have you ever been in a fight with somebody and had someone step in and try to intervene? Do you like them? Nobody likes peacemakers. Not if you're at war. I mean, strangers like peacemakers. Oppressed people like peacemakers if they can get the bully off their back. But the bullies don't like peacemakers. In this world, peacemakers are a hated group. They just are. Because we always have reasons to go to war. We always have reasons to fight. We always have reasons to sue. Peacemakers are not loved. We don't have a single role in a court of law for peacemaker. We have a prosecutor and a defense attorney, and we have sides. Where's the peacemaker? Is the judge there to make peace? No, he's to issue a ruling. He's to do justice. But in this kingdom, blessed are the peacemakers, for those are the ones who will be called the sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted. In this kingdom, those who are persecuted, who under Judaism, people would have thought were rejected by God, because remember, if you obey him, you get blessings. If you're receiving curses, you must have done something wrong. This is Job's friends, right? But those who are persecuted in this kingdom will receive the kingdom of the heavens. Blessed are you when people revile you. Blessed are you if that happens on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven. This is the God that we serve. He has come to say to those who have been shut out of the world, a kingdom is coming for you. For these folks, heaven is the answer to their prayers. So the story of Manoah reminds us again what Jesus tries to tell us in the Sermon on the Mount. God doesn't go to the great. The great don't want God. God goes to the broken, to those who society says are not important. He goes to a character in this story twice that doesn't even get a name. Her name is not even recorded. Her husband calls her this woman. And that's who God speaks with. We serve a God who goes to the least of these. And is it surprising then that when Jesus came in the flesh, he kept going to the places that the great ones told him he shouldn't be? Tax collectors and sinners, teaching women, which was against Jewish law, touching lepers, healing the lame. I mean, he's making himself unclean. They're not keeping Sabbath. All these rules. Jesus, you're not striving for the right stuff. But that's who God is. He died for us. Now, that doesn't mean that those who have succeeded in life don't get to be there too. But God really, really, really doesn't like pride. I mean, it's all over the scriptures, right? He just doesn't like pride. But what he does like is his people who go to those who are broken, who are left out, who are pushed out, who society says are not worth our time or our effort, and we live there for a while. That's who he is. And it's for them that the Sermon on the Mount was spoken. I think the story of Manoah is one of another one that introduces that theme in the life of God. Now, I'm not saying God doesn't love us all, and he does. But I imagine in heaven, if we have to wait our turn, those who have suffered the most will go first. Those who have been excluded will see him first. God has a heart for those left behind. I think the story tells us that. That's who our God is. That doesn't mean we never show tough love. God has. I mean, the poor and the broken were persecuted like everybody else in Israel when the nation fell. But God has a special heart for those that society won't listen to. Children in the Gospels, women, slaves, lepers, cripples, all people who were known to be unclean. He spent all of his time there, drove the Pharisees nuts. God is a God who goes to the broken, to those who are forgotten. I hope that you'll hear this as a hope, because we've all been that outsider somewhere at some time. But I hope you'll also hear it as a challenge, because when we have the blessing, I know what God would do. He would give it to those who don't.